This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump makes his first State of the Union address. We hear about local reaction. This week also saw the release of the State of Center City report and CMPD's crime report for 2017. We get details. A proposed rate hike by Duke Energy has some customers up in arms, and we have some new news on that. And the week saw a private Christian school announce its intention to change to a non-religious charter. A new CEO is installed at embattled Cardinal Healthcare Solutions. And a high-profile Republican congressman, South Carolina's Trey Gowdy, quits politics. Oh, and I forgot. It's also Groundhog Day. Will our news roundup panel of journalists see their shadows? Let us find out right now. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal is here. He's the senior staff writer there.
Good morning.
That's STAFF. Andos Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just preparing for our State of the Union by applauding myself in a microphone.
Well, you notice,
I noticed that Tom sat.
That's right. Folded his arms.
I was hoping they would all rise to their feet and applause.
May I introduce Sean Flynn? Would that be okay with you guys? And Sean Flynn is managing editor for the Spectrum News Charlotte.
Just nice to be included.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us on Facebook Live. President Trump, the unconventional president, made a very conventional State of the Union speech this week. And according to CBS News, those watching it cast the speech and cast him in a very favorable light. 74% approved. Of course, more Republicans watched it than Democrats. Did anything about the speech, anything the president said, surprise any of you?
That's an interesting question. I will say this. You said he gave a very conventional speech.
For him.
It's
quiet. It was presidential. It was.
But it was also, let's face it, State of the Unions tend to be really boring affairs laden with policy and laying out the priority for the next year. We barely saw any of that in this speech. It was actually surprisingly scant on where do we go from here.
Right.
You did see some basic points that you always see in a State of the Union speech. You saw, references to personal stories of the people in the crowd. You saw calls for the nation to come together and for unity to take hold and to be proud in America. But, I was surprised at the lack of.
There wasn't a lot of that specific legislation where you say, and that's why I'm going to send a bill to Congress, and I hope that you'll support me, XYZ.
People just watch Donald Trump differently than they've watched other presidents.
Yes, absolutely.
He is a reality TV president, so people were watching to see if he'd do something crazy or appeal to his base or appeal to people who are not in his base.
Aside from the fact that he did call for a, trillion-dollar infrastructure plan.
$2 trillion.
He has not laid out a lot of policies for grand vision for the future about which he would then go around the country stumping after the State of the Union, which is something most presidents have done.
Correct. Exactly. At this point, this is Friday. State of the Union, was earlier this week. At this point, you normally would have seen a president make at least two, if not three stops in different locales around the country to sell individual parts of what was laid out in the State of the Union.
Right. Well, I think – sorry, Tom. Just real quickly, I think – part of what's changed also, not only Trump being a different kind of president, but the rapid news cycle. Look, it feels like the State of the Union was 10 years ago because we've had this whole fight about Devin Nunes and the memo and all this and the train crash in Virginia, and it just feels like the State of the Union is a long time ago.
Well, you're totally right. And let me just say one thing, too. Like, you bring up, Mike, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package. Normally, in a State of the Union, you would hear how that money was going to be raised or where potential projects were going to be spent or something to flush it out. In reality, that $1.2 trillion infrastructure program includes only about $200 billion of federal money, and then basically a hope, a prayer, or a toll card is going to get you the rest of the way there.
Well, I think one of the reasons why that speech was so popular, and Ann and Eric, excuse me, I'm just going to look right over here, was because it didn't have a lot of details. I know a lot of Democratic friends of mine who said, hey, I actually kind of agreed with a lot of what he said this time, but it really didn't go into the weeds a lot and into those details.
Well, the one thing he went into detail on was immigration, and I think there was a lot of talk about unity or lack thereof. I don't believe anybody changed their minds about Donald Trump after watching that speech, but the immigration was what he really dwelt on, and again, it was about immigrants who are gang members and who have killed Americans and Americans are dreamers too. My first responsibility is to Americans. So that was not an approach that was going to generate unity.
So on the day after the speech, guest host Dr. Michael Bitzer on this program and his panel talked about the speech and got local lawmaker reaction. And here's what Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams had to say.
People are very skeptical, and I certainly am, and I know that many of my colleagues are, based on what we've seen him do. He was still, in my opinion, he's talking about unity, but he's not demonstrating that in the things that he's doing.
And can we also extrapolate that out to the speech at large? It was un-Trump-like. It was uncontained. It was rather contained. It was presidential. It was scripted. It was carefully worded, unlike his tweets and his off-the-cuff remarks. But and given his day-to-day mode of operation, do moments like this help, or do they simply muddy the waters because this is not like him?
Well, I'm not sure that I mean, I agree with you. It was not. It was not provocative in. Particularly, I guess, aggressive way, but he certainly didn't make concessions. When he was speaking about immigration, as Ann just mentioned, I mean, he read from a script and he said it in a calm way, but there wasn't any move to the middle. So I think he just had a more modulated version of what he's been saying all along.
And we've always known he can do that. He did that on election night. He literally, during the campaign, did an imitation of himself being presidential. So he can contain it. He can read from a teleprompter, but that doesn't mean that tomorrow morning we won't wake up to some very provocative tweets.
Yeah, and the Washington Post has a really interesting take on this, and I think it's absolutely right. Obviously, President Donald Trump is absolutely capable of this. His base is going to watch it. If they watch it, his true hardcore base is going to watch it and be like, well, this is what you have to do in terms of the change of tenor and tone and pace of the speech. People who either are on the fence or don't like him will watch it and see something that's more akin to what they're used to seeing a president act. But the other thing to remember here is, you've got to watch for the potential backlash. I went to a bunch of Trump rallies. I saw both the full-on off-the-cuff rally, you know, covering it for WFAE, and then the incredibly contained, scripted teleprompter rallies. And what normally followed the teleprompter rallies was something a lot more rancorous. So and to the president's credit, we have not seen that instant switch as we have in the past.
So along the lines of the Democrats seeing the speech one way and Republicans seeing it another, Republicans did take a different viewpoint of this. Here's Congressman Robert Pittenger.
Who would have guessed a year ago today we would be having a rebounding economy? 401ks are way up. People are going to be getting additional, you know, salary increases, bonuses. Apple investing $350 billion to expand in this country. ExxonMobil, $50 billion. Nobody would have ever anticipated that.
So, reflecting on the state of the economy, he's giving the president credit for the economy. Does the president get credit for the economy, or is it a holdover from the Obama economy, or can any president ever take credit for the economy, good or bad?
Well, every president is going to take credit for the economy when it's good, but not bad. this is a little bit of a mushy answer because certainly some of this is holdover from the Obama-era policies, but also he has been in office for a year. However, when Congressman Pittenger mentions things like Apple investing, did he say $350 billion? Yeah, I mean, the actual number is much less. If you look at any of the fact checks, a lot of that money was going to be spent anyway. So it gets a little bit misleading. The other thing, the tax cut, you know, we still have to sort a lot of that out. Of course, the Republican Congress and Trump get credit for passing that tax cut, but what it does to the economy still remains to be seen, including whether wages go up. Wages continue to be rather sluggish in their growth, and you're seeing, as I think we'll talk about later, a lot of companies are giving one-time bonuses. Right. That's much different than giving someone a pay raise that goes on and on.
Yeah. When Congressman Pittenger made that comment, he was on this program with Michael Bitzer, and he placed that call from the Amtrak train that just an hour later, I believe, would derail in Virginia on its way to the Republican congressional retreat at Greenbrier in West Virginia. How much more do we know about that crash than we knew on the day that it occurred?
We know that the NTSB is investigating it at this point. You know, we know that one person died. It was a passenger on the truck, not the train, that everyone on the train was fine. I don't believe the train actually derailed. I think it was just a crash. It hit a dump truck
right. That
was parked or that was, you know, crossing the railroad tracks in Charlottesville. That's basically it. I mean, you know, we've also learned that there are plenty of people in any kind of an instance that would love to jump on that on Twitter, but that's pretty much all that we know.
Okay. So just as President Trump told Americans that the state of our union is sound, so Charlotte Center City Partners reported on the health of our city, saying that the nonstop construction here is going to continue. Charlotte Center City Partners President Michael Smith made a presentation to that effect this week, as did Mayor Vi Lyles. All booms end sooner or later, I suppose, but what do the numbers tell us right now? We're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I think the thing that really jumped out at me is the fact that in 1998 there were 5,000 residents uptown, and now there are 30,000. So that's a 600% increase if my sloppy Louisiana math is working. And that's been a long time. You know, people have been here. That's been a long time obsession and focus, is to build that residential population in uptown Charlotte. So I think that's the one that really jumps out, although there was very healthy growth, obviously, with office space and a lot of hotel rooms coming online.
822 new hotel rooms, 2,997 new residential units under construction uptown, and 1.9 million square feet of office space under construction uptown. I have no concept of how much 1.9 million square feet is, but it sounds like a lot.
It's a lot.
And even the last couple of days, they just announced new plans to remove the old Polk building that's been sitting vacant for the last 10 years.
Where's that?
That's on Graham and West Trade Street. You'll notice it's the one with the scaffolding and the and the facade crumbling off.
I'm surprised that's not a historically preserved building.
They said they couldn't go in. It was like a dungeon in there, I believe, and the walls are so thick and the ceiling so low. But they just announced a 14-story tall mixed-use building with residential units and restaurants on the bottom. I mean, you can't open one of these condo buildings without a coffee shop. And put a whole bunch of those ugly bicycles on the outside.
And a dog groomer.
Literally, one of the nuggets that struck me, and this is just, it's chock full of statistics, which may or may not mean anything, but it said, Uptown has 4 elementary schools, 4 daycares, and 4 doggy daycares, compared with like 29 gyms and fitness centers, 5 craft breweries, and amazingly, it said 5 full-service groceries, but
That's a little misleading.
Rents are averaging,
I mean, the grocery store part. Go ahead.
A little over $1,600 a month. So you are seeing very much this dynamic that you have people here, but they tend to be people for the most part who don't have young children.
You know, I read an article this week about renting versus owning a house all over the country, and was that what you were going to talk about?
Well, I was just going to say I was one of those 10,000 people who lived in Uptown 16 years ago. I bought a place, and it was half as much to rent one in Uptown, and I absolutely think that people need to try and go that route. Especially, you can still get really cheap condos in Uptown.
Yeah, but the article compared renting versus owning in various cities around the country, including Charlotte. And you could put your thing in, and you would save about $400 a month in Charlotte renting.
Renting.
How about that? How about that?
So maybe I don't think I can afford either one in Uptown Charlotte.
maybe these people moving into
rural Belmont is still for me.
Journalists need not apply.
So Michael Smith, head of Charlotte Center City Partners, said that this boom is unique. Normally, he said, it doesn't come together like this, and he credited that to the deep recession that we went through and the pent-up frustration, the pent-up demand that recession created. Did he give any indication of how much longer this could last in 20 seconds or less?
Mike, if anybody had that answer, they would be on a beach not answering questions.
And they keep talking about how great this thing is. My commute is doubling with all the construction on Moorhead. And
take the train.
All right. March 2018, take the train.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more of the News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News Charlotte, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. There was another retreat. The Republicans went to Greenbrier, and the city council went to Durham.
All I got was Durham.
That's a major topic of discussion during the city council retreat, evidently. Was an item that will be on the ballot in November in Charlotte, whether to increase the amount allocated to the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We have that referendum on the ballot every 2 years, and recently it's been $15 million. But the city's Economic Mobility Task Force has recommended boosting that to $50 million. Luana Mayfield, a Democrat on the council, believes, and she's on the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, thinks it should go up. She thinks 25, maybe even $80 million. Now, Vile Isles had something else to say about this. She says we have about 18,000 homes or apartments. They were built before 1970, and they're often called naturally occurring affordable housing, but they're suddenly in demand because they're in neighborhoods near uptown. And she says that one of the most important things the city can do is preserve these units.
I heard one of our presenters today say that we should acquire housing stock, the complexes that were built in the 1970s, bring them up to a standard that we can keep them affordable. I like that one a lot.
This is really a tough issue for Charlotte.
Well, I was going to say, this is not surprising. Going back to the protests that morphed into violence and, I guess, riots or many riots, the council in their letter that they sent to the community, they made affordable housing one of the key, I guess, goals and targets that they would address, and they've been talking about it a lot. So I think this is entirely anticipated, and it ties in a little bit to the last subject we were talking about, which is Michael Smith at Charlotte Center City Partners also is concerned a little bit about those rents, $1,600 a month, and you know, forcing out people, not being affordable enough. So this, I think, is a very popular issue, and I would expect they will move on this.
Okay. The CMPD also released a report this week. They released the report on 2017 crime statistics, and Chief Kerr Putney painted a mixed picture. But as he has before in conversations on this program and elsewhere, he stressed the impact of the rising homicide count.
85 senseless losses of life is bigger than the statistic would lead you to believe. We're talking about families that have been hurt, families that have been traumatized. So we don't take that number lightly.
We saw a 25% increase last year in homicides, and that has made Chief Putney frustrated at times, but 60 of the 85 homicides have been solved. Is that a good ratio? Sounds pretty good, 60 of 85.
That's actually above the national average.
Yeah.
The clearance rate. CMPD traditionally boasts that they have a good clearance rate.
Okay. So homicides were up significantly, according to the report. Domestic violence incidents accounted for more than a quarter of those homicides, and reported cases of rape increased to 306. Putney believes that the reason people are stepping up and reporting these cases of rape and other sexual offenses is because of what's happening nationally with the Me Too movement. But not all crime was up, and that's the good news here, I suppose. Some of the numbers are falling. Where are we seeing a decrease?
Well, in overall violent crime, about 3.6%. Mm-hmm. Property crime decreased by over 5%. At one point, Chief Putney said that basically about 3,000 fewer Charlottians were victim of a crime in the last year. So what we're seeing is it's an interesting trend, but it is still a bit disturbing. On the violent side, you are seeing an increase with homicides and rape. But on the property side, on the burglaries, on the, you know,
car theft
and overall violent crime, it is going down. And it's not an earth-shattering decrease, but it is important to note. And any decrease is a good decrease.
Do you think that gets enough publicity? We talked a lot in this last year about the homicide count because it kept going up and up and up. Sometimes there were one or two a day, it seemed like, for days on end. We talk a lot about that for that reason. But are we talking enough about crime being down overall?
Probably. I mean, the police would probably say not. But you also have to remember that we often don't get these numbers and can't really sense a trend until we get these year-end briefings.
And Chief Putney was saying these are not numbers to jump up and down about, that, you know, it's good. You always want to see a decrease in anything. But even he is acknowledging that he's putting the emphasis on homicides.
And I mean, it's natural that we're going to focus on it, that they're going to focus on it. This is absolutely the most horrible act that can occur. So I think that's only natural.
And I think we do cover a lot of the other type of property crimes that are that do happen. I can't tell you how many times we've now done stories on telling people not to start their cars and leave their cars running in their driveways or in the gas stations. CMPD released a surveillance video last week of a woman who literally parked her car 2 feet away from the door of the convenience store. She runs in, And you can see the guy looking around and just hops right in and takes off with their car. So we've done a lot of those types of stories. But again, those are the smaller type of property crimes where no one's getting hurt.
Chief Putney also talked about healing families. This sounds more like a report from the health department and not the police department. But he said, we know if we heal an individual and a family, we are preventing crime. Everybody knows that research demonstrates that if you have a mental health issue, lack of education, lack of employment opportunity, and drugs, you're likely to engage in criminal behavior, and we want to break the cycle. So that's obviously reflective, I think, of a new way of thinking within law enforcement.
Well, but I think this one has been coming for a while, not only nationally, but here. You've heard Chief Putney has talked a lot, particularly in the past 2 years, about domestic violence, about trying to curb domestic violence early before it turns to the absolute worst outcome. You've seen a lot of the outreach in neighborhoods. So I think this is something that they've been pretty consistently moving towards, and they're going to continue doing that because, as we've talked about a lot on this show, many of the homicides are coming from domestic people who know each other.
Yeah, and let's not forget, I mean, last year you had a public conversation mm-hmm. about homicides with Chief Putney, and one of the things that he has said time and again is if we knew what was causing this, if it was a simple fix, we would be out there with every resource we have to fix it. It's not a simple fix. It's a bigger, more complicated fix.
And it does you have to go in with the Opportunity Task Force, the idea that you can't take crime in a vacuum, you can't take housing in a vacuum, education. They're all really interconnected, but unfortunately not lending themselves to quick solutions.
And I know in the last 6 months they've been really talking about trying to house all resources for domestic violence victims in one place so they can get that help they need. They've even talked in the last couple of weeks, they've talked about domestic violence victims and places to take their animals and their pets. So that one of the reasons that the Humane Society nationally says one of the reasons why people don't leave abusive relationships is because they're fearful what's going to happen to the animals. So they're even looking at that angle to try and address it.
So if violent crime and other sorts of crime are down overall, is that because of some sort of an approach that the police department has been taking over the last year or two or three that has resulted in that? Are they attributing that to more foot patrols, officers becoming friendlier with the people that they observe, mentoring children, things like that?
I think just in general, it's hard to attribute any one action to an increase or a decrease in crime. I think that what you're seeing here, it's similar to what you see in education policy, which Ann knows much better than I do, or military policy, which is you're trying to go after the outlying causes that lead to more stress that then can lead to the really serious problem. I think that's what's going on with the police.
Because Putney has credited his officers for getting to know residents better, for taking initiatives that the department has taken initiatives in neighborhoods and mentoring and tutoring young people.
Well, I mean, we know those things are important. We just don't know the direct. Can you say that when you do that, that it reduces crime by 2% or 3%? I mean, it's hard to quantify, but I think that people realize that it is of value.
And as Sean said, property crime is probably more amenable to prevention efforts in that you can get the word out there that, you know, there are things you can do to avoid being a victim of auto theft or purse snatching or whatever. Homicide, you know, that's a very difficult thing to head off.
And I know the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in the last couple of years have been really trying to crack down on some of the hardcore gangs that have been around here, the MS-13, the Blood UBN. And I know they've taken, I don't know the exact number, but well over 100 of them off the streets. I think that obviously that's probably where a lot of that really violent crime comes from. But the story that really sticks out in my head last year was that morning shootout at a gas station where two guys at a gas station just start shooting at each other. It's caught on surveillance. One bullet hits a school bus. And the whole time you're sitting there looking at this and just, why? Why are they doing that? That one, I don't know why that one struck me really hard last year. Mm. And I don't even know how you can address that.
Well, moving on, Duke Energy, although the crime rate's going down, Duke Energy wants to raise rates.
Is there a correlation?
No. As of yesterday, not this morning, but as of yesterday, Duke Energy wanted to raise electricity rates by 13.6% in Western North Carolina, which would include Charlotte. And that got a very chilly response from customers at a public hearing on Tuesday.
There is no way with Social Security, I can afford 19 more dollars.
This request is totally wrong for Duke Power to pass their losses and failed efforts to the end customer.
It hits poor people the hardest. They have to pay that basic charge even if they never turn on their lights or heat.
So the losses and failed efforts that that one speaker was referring to was the what it's going to cost to clean up the coal ash mess. And I believe it had something to do with the nuclear power plant in South Carolina that they're part of.
That didn't come to be.
Yeah. So that was all on Tuesday. And as of yesterday, they wanted to raise rates an average of 16.7% in some places. That's $18.72 more than a typical customer pays right now. The Observer ran an editorial on Thursday saying that customers shouldn't have to pay for coal ash cleanup. That should fall to shareholders. Last night, the light turned on.
But it wasn't over coal ash cleanup. They have not backed down on coal ash. What they have, what the Observer editorial also pointed out, was that they were getting about a $200 million federal tax break because of this new tax bill. And they were saying, well, instead of just kind of distributing that to the shareholders, why not put that toward rates? And then Duke Energy has announced that they do, in fact, plan to do that, leading to an unspecified decrease in rates in the short term and less of an increase in the long
term. So Duke was asking for $647 million in rate increases. $336 million would go to coal ash cleanup. And last week, the state's utility consumer advocate, the public staff, called for a $289 million rate decrease. And the Observer said that if you subtract the coal ash cleanup costs, that would leave Duke with a need for $311 million, which could be cut again by money from the tax cuts that came our way, which would save about $210 million. So they're taking the Observer's advice? Is that what you're telling me?
I think that Peter St. Ange and Taylor Batten can single-handedly claim credit for this, yes.
They are now the co-CEOs of Duke Energy. Yes,
exactly.
And pay raise to come.
Yeah, I was going to say, could they say all journalists need a significant raise, please?
There you go. I'm still waiting for that $1,000 bonus.
So how would this affect if they're really going to
go to Lowe's?
Are they going to do this?
We don't know. I mean, they announced that they would, but there are still no numbers attached.
I see.
Right.
So, you know, they could ask for significantly less. They could ask for a tiny bit less. We just don't know the specifics.
Do we know what they're reacting to? Have they seen the light because they suddenly, that taxing, we never thought of that. Or is it because of what was said at the public hearing? Was it because of the editorial? Is it because this is not good optics at the moment? Why would they change their mind?
Every time they have a proposed rate increase, you're going to have people coming out and saying, I can't afford it. It's just a matter of fact.
Of course.
That happens. They know that was coming. By the way, today is the fourth anniversary of the Dan River coal ash spill.
That's right.
And so 4 years later, we're still talking about this, and it's still a significant issue across the state and a very expensive one at that. But I think with the taxing, you're seeing more and more companies the last few days coming out with how they're going to divvy up the newfound money. I mean, you talk about Lowe's giving employees upwards of $1,000 in bonus. Duke now talking about giving customers a less of a rate increase, or you know, their headline said reducing the power rate. So I think it's just unfortunately, I think it's more about good timing than necessarily the power of the Observer editorial board. But
it's also some good PR to keep.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's going on.
One of the key things here that a lot of the coverage of the actual meetings forget or didn't mention, I should say, is that part of the increase is not just cleaning out coal ponds. They're basically trying to get ratepayers to pay for the bottled water that Duke went to extremes to say we're providing, not because they thought it was necessary and B, because they are good neighbors. And now they want the ratepayers to pick up that cost.
But they're also saying that it's to provide that new clean energy, the solar panels that they keep expanding all over.
Sure.
So stay tuned. We'll find out what the savings will be for ratepayers, if there are savings, in future weeks to come. But Ann has brought us a first today. A Christian school is removing religion from the curriculum next year so that they can become a charter school, and they're also agreeing to meet state standards. Does that mean as a religious school they didn't have to, or they didn't meet state standards?
Private schools, period, have the freedom to do basically what they want. The idea is it's the parents' choice, and If they choose a curriculum that wouldn't mesh with North Carolina standards, that's a parent's choice. If they have
Do homeschoolers have to meet state standards?
Very few, I think. They have to. There are some minimum standards.
So, what is the motivation for removing religion from a religious school and going and becoming a charter school?
$3 million a year in state money if they can get the enrollment they want.
Are they at risk of going under at the moment?
Apparently not, because the state says that's one of the things they looked for, that it has always been possible for a private school to apply for and receive a charter, and some have. This is the first time that we know of that a religious school has made that application.
So parents have made the choice to put them, and we haven't named the school. What is the school?
Mountain Island Day School.
The parents have made the choice to put their children in that school, and that school offers Bible classes, prayer at lunch, weekly chapel, things like that. There's a saying on there's a plaque at the front of the at the entrance of the school that has a religious connotation to it. When they become a traditional charter, all of that goes away. Are parents upset?
Well, I only got to talk to one parent, but what I heard from the founders is that, and they were a school that really had a secular curriculum, it had licensed teachers, it appeared to be not just a Bible class that was called a school, but a genuine educational school to start with. And what they said was that the parents are willing to take the trade-off because, with costs being what they were either going to need to raise tuition or back away from offering high school, which is very expensive, or convert to a charter school. So if you are there and if you are chosen to stay, this is apparently the biggest point of controversy, is that they can't just say, give us the public money for the kids that we've already accepted. Mm-hmm. If there are more applicants than spaces, everybody goes into a lottery. And so kids who have been together for multiple years, some of them might be told, you can't be here anymore. And that's apparently a bigger chafing point with the parents than the loss of prayer and Bible lessons.
And the head of that school told The Observer that they already have students from various denominational backgrounds. They have Catholics, they have Baptists, they have Buddhists, they have atheists. So they already have students of a wide diversity, evidently, attending that school.
Yeah.
When we come back, I want to talk about something you reported first yesterday and that appears in the paper this morning about teacher pay raises and paychecks and the trouble that's still contained therein. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with four journalists. That must mean it's the weekly news roundup. Sean Flynn is here from Spectrum News. Woo. Charlotte, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and our own Tom Bullock from WFAE News. You reported yesterday for the first time, I guess on the website yesterday, and it's in the paper this morning, I've been criticized for saying the paper when I should be saying the Charlotte Observer, and I want you to know that I've been criticized by our management, not yours.
Okay.
So I'll be clear about that. That teacher merit bonuses are booming, with about 8,800 expecting raises in this week's paychecks based on their students' 2017 achievements. But that's a huge increase, evidently, over last year. But not all teachers are cheering. Why not?
Well, first of all, not all teachers get the bonuses. 8,800 seems like a lot until you consider that we have about 95,000 teachers. There are teachers who are not at all eligible because they don't teach the subjects or the grade levels. For instance, K-2 teachers aren't eligible. Many high school teachers are not eligible. And then it's a competitive type of thing based on this growth calculation. And so the top 25% are eligible for different bonuses based on that. And there are people who would say, but teachers work as a team. You know, everybody in a school is responsible for better reading or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's the raises versus bonuses question, which you'll hear, I think, all over the place. A bonus is a one-time thing. It's nice. You can't count on it. It doesn't become part of your pension. It doesn't become part of your moving forward. So the North Carolina Association of Educators is saying this is just not the right way to go about it. If you've got money to spare, and of course, they would also argue that the state should be putting more money even than this into teacher pay, that that's where it ought to go. And the state legislature, meanwhile, is saying, we have put money into raises, and they are correct. There have been raises in recent years. But we also want to reward results for students instead of just sticking around or earning a degree. So there's that tension.
That's the first time I've heard that bonuses don't count in your pension. And, of course, they wouldn't, because it's not ongoing compensation.
Right.
So that really is a problem down the road for a lot of these people, because if they just keep giving you bonuses, you better be saving those bonuses and not spending them.
Right.
For your retirement. Is that an underlying reason why they do it that way, perhaps? Because they don't have to, because the pension funds in states and cities and municipalities all over the country are overcommitted, shall we say.
Right. I think this is more about the philosophy of how you pay teachers. And the legislature is always looking at the persistently low scores that you have among some demographic groups, among many schools, and saying, well, you on the school boards have not managed to fix this, so we're going to tell you how to fix this. So whether it's we're going to give bonuses to your high-performing teachers, or whether it's going to we're going to make sure that you have smaller class sizes in the early grades, which is another huge point of contention out there. You know, the state tends to hand down solutions, and the local districts often say, no, let us figure it out.
Meanwhile, two lawmakers who normally make policy found themselves the victim of policy this week. Representative Scott Stone and State Senator Dan Bishop both scheduled meetings with CMS principals this week. They have children in the system, both of them, in those schools, and they launched a fact-finding mission to hear about the impact of the legislature's decision to reduce class size. But a former GOP legislative colleague, Charles Jeter, who now works for CMS, got in the way. What happened?
He sent a response to them saying, we don't want you meeting directly with our principals on matters that pertain to the CMS legislative agenda. I'll take that meeting. Thanks. And, of course, Scott Stone, who's been kind of the point person on this, called foul on that. I would hate to be a principal in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure whether the principal, I would guess that almost certainly the principals went to someone over their head and said, how do I handle this?
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, the legislators are constituents and are representatives who ultimately decide a lot of school funding. You don't want to get on their bad side. You also work for CMS. You don't want to get on their bad side. And this class size cap is, the way it plays out is so complicated that you have not just dueling perspectives, but literally dueling facts. Part of what this is about is this really imposing this huge hardship on districts across the state? And the districts are pretty unified in saying that it does so. But these two legislators in particular have been really coming at CMS, coming at Charles Jeter, who's been the spokesperson on this, and saying, okay, you told us you need 325 teachers and $23 million. I may have the numbers off slightly, but you've given us these big numbers. Break it down for us. And I've asked for that breakdown, too, and I have not yet seen it. So the principals may be glad to be shielded.
And interestingly enough, this puts Jeter in an interesting position, because as a legislator, he voted for this legislation about which led to smaller class sizes and which has led to this so-called unintended consequence of needing more teachers to accomplish this and therefore more money. But now, as a CMS employee, he advocates a reversal of course.
Yep.
Is that just because he's working for CMS, or does he now realize that the law that they passed does have these consequences?
Well, the House has agreed that there are these consequences, so he is not alone. He's not just singing a different tune.
Okay.
Clearly, there are aspects to this that are more complicated, but again, there are people who call it an unfunded mandate, and that makes the legislators really mad, because they say correctly that they have provided funding for more K-3 teachers. And again, we could spend an hour trying to parse through this. I am trying to fact check this, and it gets so wonky so fast. But what CMS and most districts would say is, thank you, you did provide some funding, but not enough unless we make some really painful trade-offs.
So politics there and politics everywhere. We live in a political world, and although the players are changing relatively quickly here. This week, South Carolina U.S. Representative Trey Gowdy surprisingly decided to quit politics. This is a guy who's kind of a rising star in South Carolina.
Not kind of, and not just in South Carolina. I mean, Trey Gowdy has quickly, he was elected in, 2010? He represents, Greenville, Spartanburg,
state,
South Carolina's fourth.
Very red area of the state.
Deep, deep, deep red. And he, just in the relative brief amount of time that he has been in the U.S. House of Representatives, most people will know him as the chair of the Benghazi Committee.
Right.
He is chair of the Oversight Committee. He is a member of the House Intelligence Committee. He has some plum spots that in the past it would take you at least a decade in the House to become a member of, let alone chairman of. And there was no sign that he was about to do any of this, mm-hmm. at least not publicly. And lo and behold, you know, on the day after the State of the Union, he announces that he's done.
So he says he can play a more important role in the courtroom, and he enjoys the legal system more than he enjoys the political system.
Great quote,
is there
isn't
more
it?
To yes? Is there more to it than that, though?
Well, you'd have to ask.
I mean, he lives in a very red district. There's no chance he would lose.
No,
if he ran.
No,
and he's incredibly
would lose.
Popular there. And his background. I mean, the judicial aspect makes sense from his background.
True. But he's worked as a federal prosecutor. He's worked as a state solicitor. He is a lawyer. What's fascinating to me, though, was just that I enjoy the courtroom far more than the political system. And it's telling, too, because Trey Gowdy is not happening in a vacuum. You've got at least, accounting Gowdy, I think now it's 9 high-profile Republicans just in the House of Representatives that have said, you know, thanks.
I have a different count. I have 8 chairmen of committees, Republican chairmen of committees, who are leaving.
Does that count, Trey?
I believe it does. Okay. And then more than 36 other GOP House members leaving.
Yeah, and some of that, I mean, I understand the difference in numbers now. Some of that, you always get natural churn. There are some people who just decide either A, politics is not for them, or B, I've led my course, or C, frankly, I don't want to get humiliated with a primary defeat or lose.
And there is also, though, this idea that this could be a wave election. I mean, that's the talk.
Yeah, and you're exactly right, Ark. And that's the next thing I would bring up.
That's not going to happen in his district.
Not in his district, but in a lot of those other cases.
So why not stick around and get because he doesn't want to be demoted?
I think he's just tired. He's just tired of dealing with it. He's just, okay. I mean, politics has gotten dirty. It's seemingly dirtier the last few years. Mm. I think he's just tired.
Okay, another Trey made news this week. Trey Sutton is the interim CEO at the beleaguered Cardinal Innovations Healthcare. He wants to change the organization's culture.
What's become clear to me is that there is a culture of fear here. Fear of making the wrong decision, fear of retribution. And I think that's part of the culture change that I intend to drive.
Okay, so Tom, remind us. This is the company that handles a lot of different kinds of Medicaid services for patients in 20 North Carolina counties, mm-hmm. including Charlotte-Mecklenburg. They got themselves into a little trouble last year, all during the year, and it came to a head in December of last year. And
November.
In December, the state took over.
November. Yes.
Why? Time flies.
November. To Wapner.
Can I trust you on that? And as of this week, there's a new board and a new interim CEO. Sum it up. Where are we? What's going on?
Well, Cardinal Innovations is obviously trying to change and trying to kind of turn a new page. And I think what's happening here, especially from that clip of Mr. Sutton that you just played, is it's you could, I think, fairly compare it to Cardinal's own version of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We had heard a long time, once we started reporting on Cardinal after the first audit, people would call us or drop us emails or fax us things where they would talk about the culture of fear. Hmm. And we heard individual stories. And no one wanted to go on the record because they were afraid of retribution. And this, it is important to point out, is not just about employees, current or former. It's also about the patients. And these patients, you know, specifically, let's make sure we focus the group on the right set of patients. These are patients with developmental disabilities, mental health issues, addictions that are on Medicaid. They get Medicaid money. That's what Cardinal administers. So there was this broad kind of feeling of you don't cross now the former boss at Cardinal or there will be repercussions.
And the other thing they're trying to fix is not just the culture of fear, but the culture of wasteful spending that they were perceived to have done with huge pay for executives and with expensive retreats and paying bar tabs and the new board. Pretty much as soon as that official handoff took place and the state said, you all are in charge now, they did pass bylaws or resolutions saying, no, we're not going to, you know, we will stick to the state pay scale. We will not be holding these elaborate retreats.
Well, they're not.
No more Christmas parties.
Not sticking to the state pay scale already because evidently the new CEO, the interim CEO, is making more than the rules that govern the so-called local management entity managed care organizations, of which Cardinal is.
LME MCOs, baby.
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't
it? He's making more money than the state normally pays. Why?
Well, because the state said in this case it's okay. And that's an important caveat.
Yeah, getting approval.
Yeah, he got approval ahead of time. Now, you have to consider a couple of things here. First of all, the state minimum for the president or CEO of one of these organizations is just over $204,000. Trey Sutton will make $230,000. So that's $26,000 or thereabouts above what was considered by state rule and state law.
Right.
But he has a waiver from the state to say it's okay. In comparison, former CEO, the controversial former leader of Cardinal, was making $635,000 in base salary alone, and in his last year of employment made $1.3 million, including a bunch of one-time
payments. And got, what, 3 years of severance to that effect as well?
With the $635,000,
okay. Yeah. Speaking of Richard Topping, the former CEO and the former board, they were back in court this week.
Yeah, the Cardinal saga, I'll tell you, it is I always feel like there's something strange that could happen as when it involves Cardinal. So the same day that my colleague Alex Olgan interviewed Trey Sutton, I was in a courtroom not too far away, exactly the same time, actually, for what could have been just a regular procedural motion. And this deals with the state's belief that certain former members of Cardinal's former board may have been trying to shuffle off money or all sorts of things. So they were trying to get what's called a preliminary injunction, basically also establishing that the new board is the new board and the new interim CEO is the new interim CEO. Mm-hmm. Richard Topping was sitting there with them and tried to testify, but the judge said, no, this is a procedural hearing. We're not going to let you do that.
All right, we're going to run out of time. There are a couple of stories I got to hit before we go out of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is this. The Panthers, as soon as they announced that the Panthers were going to go on the market, everybody got nervous about whether or not they would leave town. There's still no guarantees that they'll stay, but this week NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell spoke up about it.
I think all of us and the owners believe that Carolina is a great market. It's a market we would like to stay in, and we hope that the franchise owner that's eventually selected will have that view.
Why did he make that statement this week, Eric?
Well, somebody asked him the question, so that's why he made the statement. But the NFL's been pretty consistent ever since Jerry Richardson said he's going to sell the team. And I do think it's highly unlikely that they're going to move, but the NFL or any other sports league would never give up the leverage of having that threat once they get into a stadium fight or if they get into a stadium fight.
When they get into a stadium
fight. And speaking to people who play in the big game this weekend, because we're not a Super Bowl station, so we can't call it that. We have to call it the big game. We might as well hear something that's rarely heard on public radio, but that is almost inescapable on commercial television. Take a listen.
They have arrows with fire, which probably don't hurt more than the regular ones. And unlike them, we have very little training. Look, I'm going to level with you guys. We're out of Bud Light. And they have some! So dilly dilly!
That's a portion of a commercial that you've seen 1,000 times and will see a lot during the Super Bowl, and it features John Hugenacker as the king giving the pep talk. He's from Charlotte.
Dilly dilly.
See, we didn't need Amazon as a city to restore our pride. We have a Super Bowl commercial.
And how can you move the Panthers when the king of dilly dilly is from here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So congratulations to John because he's got national attention. You're about to see him in Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan on Amazon, and he's already on Colony on the USA Network.
That's right.
He's doing well for
himself. That's right. Yes.
Meanwhile, it's Groundhog Day. Both Punxsutawney Phil and Queen Charlotte, the groundhog, saw their shadows today. And you know what that means? You know what that means? I guess
it
they
means
don't.
We don't have our sound clip.
Our clip. I don't know what
it's back
thinking.
In its den, hiding for six more weeks.
Right.
Six more weeks.
I want to know what they're.
All right, they're not going to play it.
Somebody get Bill Murray, Andy McDowell.
Did
what's
you actually,
going on?
Did it was you have gonna, Queen Charlotte talking?
No, it was Bill Murray saying it's going to be. It's going to last you for the rest of your life. But I. All right, that's all the time we have. They saw the shadow. 6 more weeks of winter, 6 more weeks of this show, at least.
Dilly dilly.
Dilly dilly.